You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, folks. Ben here with a quick favor to ask. There are some great advertisers who support the show, and in order for them to continue doing that, I need your help. Please do me a favor and go to podsurvey.com/kick and take a quick anonymous survey that will help us get to know you a little better. Even if you've taken our show's podcast listener survey before, the current one is new and different, so I'd really love for you to take it again. Plus, once you've completed the survey, you can enter to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Again, that's podsurvey, podsurvey.com/kick. Thanks for your help, and now enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. A little over 10 years ago, Mike Judge, the creator of the TV series Silicon Valley and King of the Hill, wrote and directed a film envisioning a dystopian society where citizens have rebelled against intellectual curiosity, social responsibility, and reason in favor of populism, commercialism, and anti-intellectualism, resulting in an America mired in ignorance and dysfunction. The film Idiocracy has recently enjoyed a cult revival as life imitated art during the 2016 election and subsequent events in which President Donald Trump has extolled the virtues of the poorly educated, legitimized conspiracy theories and conspiracy theorists like Alex Jones, and rebranded outright lies as alternative facts. Now, in a new book called The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters, my guest today says we're devolving into a society in which all voices, even the most ridiculous, demand not just to be heard, but to be taken with equal seriousness, and any claim to the contrary is dismissed as undemocratic elitism. Furthermore, he warns that this dangerous phenomenon could have disastrous consequences for the stability and survival of our republic in the 21st century. Tom Nichols is himself an expert in defense and national security, Russia, and nuclear arms control. He's a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College and an adjunct professor in the Harvard Extension School. He is currently a senior associate of the Carnegie Council on Ethics and International Affairs and a fellow of the International History Institute at Boston University. Prior to that, he served as personal staff for foreign and defense affairs to the late U.S. Senator John Hines of Pennsylvania. He was a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and a fellow of the International Security Program and the Project on Managing the Atom at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. He's also a 5-time undefeated Jeopardy champion, and as one of the all-time top players, he was invited back to play in the 2005 Ultimate Tournament of Champions. He's the author of 7 books, including Winning the World, Lessons for America's Future from the Cold War, Eve of Destruction, The Coming Age of Preventative War, No Use, Nuclear Weapons and U.S. National Security, and his newest book, The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. Today, he'll discuss Americans' alarming disdain for expertise, experience, and qualifications, and their eager embrace of amateurism and cluelessness. He'll reveal why higher education is part of the problem, and how much of the responsibility for the death of expertise lies with the experts themselves. He'll discuss how one study has shown that the internet is actually making some people dumber, and how fact-checking sites like Snopes are fighting a losing battle against the rapid proliferation of disinformation. He'll discuss how a love of conspiracy theories and disdain for academics and experts is inherent in the American spirit of independence and self-reliance, but how this contempt for established knowledge could lead to the erosion of democracy in America itself. Plus a few tips on how to consume a balanced diet of news every day, and how to win at Jeopardy from this five-time champion. Coming up with Professor Tom Nichols in just a moment. Tom Nichols is a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College, an adjunct professor in the Harvard Extension School, and a former aide in the U.S. Senate. He is also the author of several works on foreign policy and international security affairs, and a five-time undefeated Jeopardy champion. He's written a new book called The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. Professor Nichols, thanks for joining me over Skype.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
You say that people are more impressed a lot of times by the fact that you are a five-time Jeopardy champion than with your long list of credentials and publications. Does that say something about our criteria for judging expertise in this day and age?
Yeah, it does. It's been for quite a while that unless something happens on TV, it's not real. One of my favorite moments about Jeopardy is about 20 years ago when I was first on and I was teaching at Dartmouth College, and I was a young professor and I sort of thought I was very cool for having this great job and I'd written a book and all that stuff. And a student saw me on Jeopardy and he walked up to me and he said, "Professor Nichols, I saw you on TV. I had no idea you were so smart." And it did speak to kind of an essential truth that, being on television and answering quiz questions is more in line with what people would say is smart than, the kind of expertise that you would normally think would credential you to talk about things like foreign policy or international affairs.
I wonder if perhaps the future of game shows may no longer be a hard measurement of intelligence, whether you're either right or wrong. Maybe the next generation of game shows are going to be where the answer is entirely subjective or measured by audience applause.
Well, it seems to already be happening, right? I mean, American game shows are almost getting to be more like Japanese game shows where, it's sort of see how much you can put the contestant through and how much humiliation they can take rather than what they know. But I think it still says something good that there's still a healthy audience for Jeopardy out there and that smarts still matter. But yeah, it's a little worrisome.
Well, in your book, The Death of Expertise, you say, quote, "The United States is now a country obsessed with the worship of its own ignorance." Judging by the news lately, I don't know that I can disagree with you. I guess my question would be, we've always kind of teased the nerd in class, my generation, my parents' generation, perhaps even my grandparents' generation, maybe called academics Poindexter or was distrustful of intellectuals. Why is this different?
It's a great question because distrusting intellectuals really has a long American pedigree. You can find it all the way back to Tocqueville, that Americans, we pride ourselves on our common sense. We don't have the same kind of very structured class or educational background that old Europe had, the British Empire. So some of it's understandable. And teasing the nerd in class, sure, a lot of really smart people sometimes aren't that well socialized. You know, the guy who's really good at doing differential equations in his head probably isn't that good at making small talk. What's different now is that people are actually proud of not knowing things. They're proud of not having achievements or knowledge in the thing they're talking about, because it's almost like an act of empowerment to say that I reject the advice of experts and I don't listen to people who know more than I do. It's a way of saying, you know, I'm independent, I'm strong. You saw the president running on this during his campaign. Who knew? Right. What if I didn't have experts? Who cares about experts? You know, the experts are terrible. And it's not even just in the United States. You saw it in Brexit, in the UK as well, where the Brexiteers were saying things like, well, you know, people have had enough of experts. And it's almost like a kind of a new declaration of independence to say, I'm so smart that I don't need anybody smarter than me. But it's really not true. And we all need people that are smarter than us in other things. Nobody's good at everything.
And, you know, while we would tease, say, the nerd in class, people used to look up to the Einsteins and medical doctors. Academics were people who we trusted and admired.
Another great point, right? Even the guys that we would tease in class and call Poindexter, you know, or propeller head, we always said it with a bit of kind of grudging admiration, right?
Right.
You know, you'd say, well, that guy's a little weird, but he's the one that's going to get into MIT or Caltech. Now, I think what's different is that a lot of Americans don't feel like they're in control of their lives, and they're looking for somebody to blame. They feel like the world's become incomprehensibly complex. And this actually happens in societies in cycles, where it feels like the world is kind of spinning out of control. The world is really complicated. It's hard to, and the only people who seem to understand things are experts. And if they're the only people who understand them, they must be to blame for whatever it is that you don't like. I'll add one more thing and say that we live in an information age. And unlike previous eras, the information age has drawn a much stronger distinction between people who can prosper in a demanding information economy and people who can't. Now society tends to value information a lot more, and it leads to a lot of social resentment. Even with people that are doing okay economically, they're still feeling kind of social resentment that smartness seems to be more valued or to give you more of an advantage in society.
Is it that people in this day and age are any dumber or less willing to listen to experts than they were before? Or is it that we can hear them all and they're amplified by things like the internet and social media?
Oh, that last point is really important. In the book, I say, try to imagine what the world would have sounded like in 1925 if everybody had a radio station, right? I mean, it would, you know, it would be intolerable. You know, every crank in the 1920s who believed in every conspiracy theory, you know, broadcasting at 50,000 watts. I don't think people are dumber. I think that's a cliche that, you know, kids these days, right, they're getting stupider. Mm-hmm. That's really not the case. However, there is a lot more information to master. You know, my mom and dad in the 1930s would have had to learn geometry just as an eighth grader today has to learn geometry. The difference is today's eighth grader lives in a world of space flight.
Mm-hmm.
But people are less willing to listen. And I think the bigger problem, and the word that I use a lot in the book, people aren't dumber than they used to be, but they are significantly more narcissistic than they used to be. They're much more thin-skinned. They are much more self-regarding. They are much less tolerant of being corrected. And I think that's a big part of what's driving this problem with expertise.
Even though you say that people aren't necessarily dumber, you do point out in the book a study that actually showed that young people today are less intelligent than they were a generation or two ago.
They're not inherently less intelligent than they were a generation ago. But the bigger problem, I think, is that they are less interested in learning things. We're finding, for example, that right around the time that the internet exploded, about 1990, that younger people and college-bound kids and kids in high school were far less interested in current events or public affairs than their parents were. And the reason it was such a disturbing finding is they were having this kind of apathy about learning at the same time that huge amounts of information were becoming available to them.
Is part of the problem perhaps political correctness? And we live in the society where everyone gets a trophy and everyone's opinion is treated as fact?
Yes. I'm not sure that I would call it political correctness so much as I would call it a kind of therapeutic culture. That we're a therapeutic culture of affirmation. You know, we're always taught to say, now, your view is, that's a perfectly reasonable view, and you're not wrong, but you're not entirely right. Education has become this kind of exercise in the affirmation of the self-esteem of students. You know, I really think that's a bad idea. I mean, I've had a long career as a teacher, and I think I've had a pretty good career. I think most of my students would tell you I'm pretty affable in class. I have a great time with my students, but I don't walk into class and pretend that the students know as much as I do, because if that were the case, why would I be charging them for that service, right? You know, why would they be writing checks to Harvard Extension School if I walked in and said, well, you know, your guess is as good as mine? No, that's not the case. My guesses are a lot better than the students. And I think teachers have to go back to saying that, because as you point out, we're very hesitant to ever tell people they're wrong, or that they're uninformed, or that they're undereducated, when in fact, you know, a lot of people are. That's just the way life is.
And you do say that much of the responsibility for the death of expertise and this rise in ignorance falls with higher education. What else are they doing wrong?
The problem is that colleges, because they're competing for the marginal student, now the elite schools can, you know, they can take their pick, right? They can they could fill their classes with valedictorians every year if that's what they really wanted to do. The schools that are competing for the students who may or may not go to college, or to get a hold of their loan money, or to keep them in school until at least for a few years, they're making college into an experience. And part of that experience is not telling the students they're wrong. They want the students to be happy. Well, as odd as this is going to sound to say, you know, college isn't supposed to make you happy all the time. College is supposed to be uncomfortable. It's supposed to be unsettling. That's where you learn that all the stuff you learned as a kid, all the myths and, you know, all the things that you're taught as a small child are a lot more complicated than you first realized. And I think colleges have shied away from that mission. They've tried to say, come to big state university because we have rock climbing and we have great dorms and we have terrific pizza in the quad and our teachers are all your best friends. And that's not what college is supposed to be. Some of the best college professors I ever had started off by scaring the hell out of me. You know, sometimes that's an important part of learning. And I think we've lost that. And I think the downside is when you graduate, you don't really feel like you've encountered people that are that much smarter than you, or that learning things is that difficult.
Yeah, you say that there's very little distinction being made between the teacher and the student. And one of the problems you cite is teacher evaluation surveys.
Yeah. You know, I was a department chairman, and I've had to review student evaluations both on myself and others. And again, I think it's important to tell your listeners, I have no axe to grind here because I've had very good evaluations my whole career. I've won, you know, this isn't something like, oh, I suck at teaching, so I hate the students. I've had good evaluations. I've won teaching awards at the institutions I've been at. But student evaluations really are inherently a kind of kooky enterprise where you're asking 19 or 20-year-old kids to evaluate somebody who might be 50 or 60 years old who's been doing this for 30 years. You know, colleges, for example, are famous for usually not having evaluations in courses like statistics because it's just, it's the vegetable you have to eat and nobody's going to like it. And I think that student evaluations have gone too far. Because it encourages the students to think of themselves as the judges and peers of people that are giving them grades and teaching them. I say in the book, I hate the expression, and I know there are a lot of teachers who use it, the teacher who says, well, I learn as much from my students as they learn from me. My God, do I hate that expression. You walk out of my class and I say that this was a perfectly even exchange of knowledge, then I shortchanged you somehow. Asking you on an evaluation, did you like me? Did you have fun? It's like they're reviewing a restaurant, you know, and I just think that's unfortunate.
For teachers. Yeah. For anyone who's listening who remembers Cheers, you reference Cliff Clavin a lot in this book. Cliff Clavin, of course, was the postman who hung out at Cheers, and he was, I guess, kind of a Socrates of misinformation.
Yeah, he's the annoying know-it-all who always sat at the end of the bar in every episode saying, Well, Sammy, it's a known fact, our studies have shown. And of course, the next thing that came out of his mouth was something completely crazy or inane. And one of the things I point out in the book is that we're kind of all turning into that guy, in part because we've all got a smartphone in our pocket and we're all dueling with factoids and we all want to be right all the time because we all think we're the smartest kid in the room. And it's insufferable. I mean, it's corroded our social life and made conversation. There's a chapter in the book, right? I basically say how conversation became exhausting. And it does. It makes conversation just exhausting after a while.
Well, yeah, because, we've all been at a cocktail party or some social setting where the dumbest guy in the room dominates the conversation with conspiracy theories and misinformation. And usually we all kind of smirk at each other and just nod until they shut up rather than engage them because we don't want to prolong this pointless conversation, or we're trying to be polite. By doing that, are we shirking our responsibility and maybe adding to the problem?
I don't think it's incumbent on all of us to start telling each other to shut up. I do think experts have to step forward and they have to be less shy about saying, look, I understand you have strongly held opinions here, but it's really, the thing I know is the thing I know. And I think experts have been shirking that duty because it's uncomfortable. It's confrontational. It's something you don't want to do because, we've all been at that party. We've all seen that guy. I will also say on a few occasions, I've been that guy. I think every one of us is guilty at some point in our lives where we've held forth on something where we probably should have just shut up. But, when the whole dinner party becomes everybody being that guy, then yes, I think we have to step forward and say, are we really as well informed on this as we think we are? Maybe we ought to listen to each other more than we talk.
Well, I can't just be polite and shut up. If I see, even though I'm not an expert on something, I see something that's blatant misinformation or conspiracy theories being propagated on Facebook or in a casual conversation in person, I feel that if you know something not to be true, then you have a duty to try and correct it because especially with the internet now, there are some people who don't have the time to do the kind of research that they need to on a particular subject and they'll take that as fact.
Or worse, they think that having looked at the internet briefly counts as research.
Right.
Which is really infuriating. So, I read recently and what they mean is I scanned a few lines of text on my phone recently.
Yeah.
And I feel your pain because I'm that guy too. I mean, I don't really have a lot of patience for this. I said earlier that I hate that expression about, learning as much as they learn from me. The other expression that I really hate, and I say this in the book, is let's agree to disagree.
Right.
I hate that expression with a passion because it basically says, I will consent to you being wrong and not say anything about it anymore.
Yeah. I've literally been at a social setting with a friend and another friend of mine who's a very well-respected doctor, graduated from Johns Hopkins at the head of his class, and they started talking about vaccines. And my friend, who doesn't know the first thing about medicine, said, well, I guess we'll have to agree to disagree. My doctor friend said, no, you're not a doctor. This is not an agree to disagree kind of thing.
I do that all the time. And they say, let's agree to disagree. And I say, no, let's just agree that you're wrong. Yeah. Because, if it's something I feel that I, pretty strongly right about, there is no point in agreeing. I call that a conversational fire extinguisher. Mm-hmm. The people back themselves into a corner and, the whole room is burning around them and they pull this out and they say, well, let's just agree to disagree. and they try to put it out. And I think we have to stop doing that. I think that we have to stop putting ourselves in those corners. We have to stop trying to one-up each other. Because I was asked recently, well, what can we do about this in those situations? And I said, well, we have to all start being nicer to each other. Because somehow, and I think social media plays a big role in this, mm-hmm. we've internalized the idea that the point of a conversation is not to establish intimacy or discover something about another person or to exchange information. The point of a conversation is to win.
Yeah.
And if you approach every conversation with, I'm just here to win. I'm just here to establish kind of some kind of self-actualizing dominance or make myself feel better about, that I was picked on in gym class or something, then you're really not going to get anywhere. And I think that's the thing that's got to stop. And that's what I mean about narcissism. People no longer have conversations with other human beings to say, hey, you're interesting. I want to know more about what you think. Yeah. I want to share my view with you. I want to establish a human connection. They go into these conversations instead to say, I'm here to win. I'm here to make myself feel better about me. And I think that's what's really got to stop.
Yeah. And I certainly feel that that's becoming even worse in the age of Donald Trump. Just last week, I was talking to a friend of mine who is a big Trump supporter. This was just after, I guess, Trump had tweeted that he had been wiretapped by President Obama. My friend to me, who he's a big Trump supporter, he said, you know, if this turns out not to be true, this guy's crazy. I'm like, no kidding.
Welcome to the party, pal.
Yeah. And then he says to me, but don't discount Trump. He always wins. You know, people always underestimate him, but he always comes out on top. And I said to him, I said, just because someone wins doesn't mean that they're right. It doesn't mean that they're not a liar.
Or that they've accomplished anything. You know, this is a good time for me to point out that I do not speak for the Navy or the Naval War Colleges. My personal views.
Okay.
But let me be fair to the president and say he didn't invent this either.
Right.
He's perfected it as a political tool, but he did not invent this, you know, sort of juvenile one-upmanship that Americans are using against each other. I think actually the president, during his campaign, he caught that wave and surfed it really well. But I think he's also kind of made it okay. I mean, I hate the fact that younger men in particular, I'm 56. I mean, I'm not an old codger, but I'm not a young guy. I don't like that younger men in particular see it almost as aspirational to kind of see how big a jerk they can be in a conversation or with other people because winning is everything. The fact of the matter is you can win a conversation by shutting down the other person and still lose a friend and, you know, not be a well-regarded human being. And I don't think that accomplishes very much.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more with Professor Tom Nichols when we come back in just a moment. Folks, whether you're starting an online business or trying to get your existing business online, GoDaddy wants to help. GoDaddy's mission is to radically shift the global economy toward life-fulfilling independent ventures, helping customers kick ass by giving them the tools, insights, and the people to transform their ideas and personal initiatives into success. With more than 62 million domain names under management, GoDaddy is the world's largest technology provider dedicated to small business and the largest domain registrar. They have award-winning 24/7 support and everything you need to build your online business. Whether you have a new idea or an established business, the key to success online starts with a great domain name, and GoDaddy is trusted by 13 million customers, more than any other registrar, with big savings over the other guys. And right now, my listeners can get 30% off new purchases on GoDaddy.com by using the code KICK30 at checkout. That's GoDaddy.com, code KICK30 for 30% off. Again, GoDaddy.com and offer code KICK30. And now, back to the podcast. What are young people supposed to aspire to when the leader of the free world sets this example of saying things like, I love the poorly educated, not having the most respect for facts?
I think there's a couple of ways to look at that. One is the president has started to hire experts. I mean, this happens to every president. Remember, President Obama once said, hey, I'm my own best staff, right? I know my issues better than my staff does. Every president who thinks that ends up being wrong, and they end up hiring experts to help them out. The other is that I think we just have to be better examples to each other than the president's being right now. The president's in the middle of all this political warfare. That's what he values. That's the world he lives in. That doesn't mean that we have to be like that with each other. There's more to life than winning arguments every day. And I think we have to keep that in mind.
Well, I want to talk about the internet because that's kind of the great scapegoat. The great irony is that people have never had access to more information, and yet we're increasingly resistant to facts and knowledge, you say. How do you reconcile those two?
Well, the internet's an enabler. I mean, when I started writing this book, people said, oh, it's the death of expertise. You're going to blame it all on the internet, right? And actually, no. I mean, I was encountering, you know, people giving me ill-informed lectures on my own field 30 years ago. If you think of the internet as like food, right? It'd be like saying Americans have never had more access to food than at any time in history. Unfortunately, most of it's junk food.
Right.
And that's why we're all fat and diabetic and not healthy. And the same thing is true with the internet. There's a billion websites out there. Hundreds of millions of them are awful. And we have all this information, but we graze it like a big buffet of junk food. And it's bad for us. And I think that when people ask me how to deal with the internet, I say, treat it like your diet, portion control and healthy choices.
You also say that the internet is actually changing the way we read, the way we reason, even the way we think, all for the worse. How so?
Yes. Well, it's teaching us, for example, not to read. It's teaching us to skim. And especially with children, we're finding this with younger kids. And I mean, like pre-teens even, that rather than having the patience to read a book, says the guy who just wrote a book and hopes people will have that patience, rather than sitting down and reading 250 pages, you know, people just want to click and skim because it's easy and it's in front of them and it's pretty and it flashes before their eyes. And that is changing the way our brains actually take in information. And it's changing it for the worse because you're losing your ability to follow sustained chains of reasoning that require reflection and thinking over a long period. Basically, if you don't like what you're reading, you say, you know, take it away, and you click on something else, and you can move on.
Yeah. Well, then I'm guessing that you're probably not a big fan of BuzzFeed lists, huh?
You know what? In the same way that I really like, you know, chicken fingers and cheeseburgers now and then, of course I like, but I'm a cat guy. BuzzFeed will always get me with, you know, 10 funny things your cat just did.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a sucker for that stuff. The trick is not to start your day every day with a BuzzFeed listicle. That's not informing yourself. That's like having, you know, a bag of fries and a Coke for breakfast. It's not good for you. But I'm not going to dump on BuzzFeed or, you know, HuffPo or anything. I mean, they're fun. That's what makes the internet a great thing. It's when people, again, it's like having, you know, fast food joint down the street from you. That's a great thing to have, but you shouldn't be in there every day.
Yeah. And you say that you actually open every class by telling students that they should consume a balanced diet of news every day. What would that diet entail?
I always tell students to, first of all, to read a major newspaper. Now, of course, conservatives come back at me, and I consider myself a conservative, but a lot of my conservative friends come back at me and say, well, the Washington Post or the New York Times is too biased, so I don't read it. Well, then read the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
Read the Economist. Read, you know, the Times. Read something that is a daily edited newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And then find one thing. Find a magazine or a newspaper you don't agree with and add that to your diet. When I worked in the U.S. Senate for, he's now since passed away, Senator John Hines of Pennsylvania. He's a senior Republican. And so I read all of the Republican or conservative-leaning magazines to keep up on what my guys were thinking. I then subscribed to Mother Jones, The Nation, Harper's, basically things that were the complete opposite of what my guys were thinking because I wanted to know what other people were thinking. And I think it's helpful. I think everybody should add one thing to their news diet that they don't agree with once a day.
Mm-hmm. Is this term fake news being misapplied?
Yes. People are using, and you know, unfortunately, the president is the chief offender on this one. People tend to use the term fake news to mean news I don't happen to like.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm a Russia specialist. So to me, fake news has a very specific meaning. It means something that someone sat down and created as a knowing falsehood out of whole cloth that they then seeded or planted throughout the internet specifically to mislead people. That means it's not a mistake. It's not bias. It's not spin. It's not selective reporting on something. You know, the other night we saw Rachel Maddow talking about Trump's tax returns. There wasn't anything fake news about it. It just was a very selective discussion of a kind of a non-story. That none of that is fake news. Fake news is fake. It is intentionally created as a lie in order to fool people. And I really think people need to stop using the term fake news because I think it's become a convenient shorthand for dismissing anything you don't happen to like.
I wonder if we need a better term for that, that we can specifically apply to, say, those clickbait articles that you see on Facebook or random websites by some guy in his basement, you know, Alex Jones and so forth.
Well, Alex Jones, I think, now in that case, I do think of, you know, InfoWars and Breitbart as intentionally fake news. I mean, yeah. There are stories on there, unless Alex Jones really believes in chemtrails, you know, or gay frogs or whatever his issue of the day is.
Yeah.
That there are stories that are literally fabricated stories, or seem to be so outlandish that no one could believe them. But even then, you know, places like Breitbart or I'm trying to think of some other equivalent sites like that. I mean, there are nuggets of stories in there, but they are presented so wildly that I don't think of them as fake news. I think of them as junk food.
Yeah.
I think of them as just, you know, the kind of prepackaged, full of chemical, you know, high fat junk, you know, sitting in the gas station food aisle that you shouldn't be eating.
Yeah. And the problem with this is that you say because of the sheer volume of misinformation on the internet, even Snopes and other fact-checking organizations are, to use your words, shoveling against the tide. Does that mean that this is a lost cause?
There's simply no way to keep putting out all these wastebasket fires. And the part of the problem is that every time you try to respond to one of these crazy stories, you end up having to repeat it, right? So like the story about, oh, is Obama a Muslim? So if you say, well, Obama's not a Muslim, the problem is that now you're repeating the original charge and it just starts soaking into the social fabric, and that people say, well, it's been denied enough times, maybe it's true, or I keep seeing the word Obama and Muslim. So there's actually a problem with trying to counteract every single one of these. I think the better approach is for people themselves to, first of all, to stay away from those sites. They're junk. I mean, again, it's like keeping your diet healthy. But also, if people inform themselves, it's almost like they can develop an immunity to really bad news stories. Because once you have enough foundational knowledge, once you've done enough reading, once you've kept yourself informed, the really crazy stories start to jump out at you as really crazy and stupid stories.
Yeah.
I think the problem is, if that's all you read all day, and you don't know any better, you start to interpret that as reality. And I think doing a reality check kind of immunizes you against accepting too much of that junk as real.
Yeah. And in talking about the relationship between lay people and experts in our society, you do say that there is a danger of experts just giving up and saying to hell with it and retreating to their ivory tower and refusing to engage with the public. How much responsibility for this lies with the experts themselves?
In the book, I have an entire chapter where I take the experts to task and I say, look, first of all, experts not only can be wrong, they can be frauds, right? I mean, you know, we have plenty of cases of experts who lie about their credentials, or they falsify their results, or they misrepresent their research. I mean, there's a lot of misconduct in the expert world, and experts should be first and foremost the ones to call it out. But I also think experts need to accept their responsibility to their client. Our client, as experts, as teachers, as doctors, as lawyers, as engineers, as journalists, our client is society. And we can't just retreat to talking to each other because it happens to be more comfortable that way. You know, I was recently on a panel with a scientist who was, you know, obviously brilliant. I mean, the kind of person whose brain gave you a tan just from, you know, standing near it. And it disturbed me because the scientist said, well, I don't see any of this rejection of expertise. You know, I work with other scientists all day and we all get it. And I thought, well, yeah, because you're only talking to other scientists all day.
Yeah.
And I think it's really incumbent on all of those experts, including me, including you as a journalist, including others, to engage with the public, even when it's uncomfortable, that we have to step forward and say, we know the things we know, we're here to answer your questions, but we're not just going to tell you the things you want to hear.
And you point out kind of the worst case scenario here. If we just completely disdain and ignore experts and embrace ignorance as some kind of a virtue, you say that it could lead to a crisis that would end in one of two extreme breakdowns in government. one which we might be witnessing right now, I don't know, and the other which perhaps would result from the first. What are they?
I actually have three concerns. Mm-hmm. An economic depression, a real depression, not the 2008 recession, which by the standards of American economic times was bad, but it's not nearly the worst. I would argue that the economy that I lived through in the 70s was even worse than that. And that kind of collapse could bring people back to their senses to say, oh, maybe we need to actually listen to people who know about economics. Or a war, which also concerns me, because I think the public's knowledge of foreign affairs has reached dangerously low levels. The level of public ignorance about basic issues of foreign policy is so abysmally low that I think we're on the verge of making some potentially disastrous decisions. The third thing, I only started worrying about this more as people in the vaccine issue, you talked about your friend who's a doctor, started talking to me, is that I'm also concerned about a pandemic, which I think would probably end all of this vaccine, anti-vaccine nonsense overnight. But I'm kind of hoping that doesn't have to happen first. So any one of those situations, I think, could bring us back to understanding the need for expertise, but I prefer that it happened before that.
I just want to ask you a few more questions about Donald Trump. You are a nuclear arms and national security expert. Did his answer regarding the nuclear triad kind of drive you crazy?
And scared the hell out of me, yeah. I think, if you're running to be the president of the United States, I was less concerned by the first time he bobbled that question than that 6 months later, when he was asked again, he hadn't really given it a lot of thought.
Yeah.
And I think being the steward of the American nuclear arsenal is the single most important job of the president of the United States. I understand that people in Ohio and Wisconsin think that the most important job of the president is to find them a job. I've never thought that was the right approach. The fact of the matter is only the president of the United States has the immense power of a massive nuclear arsenal at his fingertips. He's the only American citizen who has that power. And so, yeah, I found it concerning. Now, I assume that now that he's president, he's been briefed, and he has a Secretary of Defense and a National Security Advisor, I think he's probably more up to speed on those issues. But during the campaign, yeah, I wrote about it during the campaign, and it really worried me a lot. And I think it also showed that, people didn't care that he didn't know that. Maybe that was the thing that scared me more.
Yeah, me too.
It's not that he didn't know. It's that when you told people, hey, he doesn't know anything about the nuclear arsenal, and people across the country went, meh, so what? Neither do I.
Yeah. And the thing that bugged me the most about that is I would say to people, doesn't it bother you that there's someone out there who's treating you like a fool and you're okay with that?
I've been accused of, living in a bubble, right? People I know that are very supportive of the president, they say, he talks to me in a way that I understand. He's just like me. Now, my answer to that is I have never wanted the president to be just like me. I want a president who's smarter than I am. I want a president who's basically a better person than I am. Yeah. And he has more. I'm just an average man. I'm flawed. I have all kinds of, human failings. So I've always wanted the president to be someone I think is better and smarter and more capable than I am. But Americans are in the grip of this populist fever where they are so sensitive to the notion that anybody would talk down to them or know more than them, that they find it refreshing. And on this, I'm going to put a little bit of blame on Barack Obama.
Yeah.
Because he came across as very diffident, very professorial, mm-hmm. condescending, yeah. Detached. And, 8 years now, that if you were one of his supporters, you didn't mind. If you weren't one of his supporters, that really came across as, deeply patronizing and wounding. And I think people were tired of that. But I also don't think, this is the right answer to that problem either.
In one of the humble admissions in your book, you actually say that you got Vladimir Putin wrong. How do you feel about Vladimir Putin these days?
I have no idea what you're talking about, and I have to end this interview now. No, I did. I got Putin wrong. I mean, I can't get away from that. I wrote a chapter of a book about 16 years ago, and I said, well, maybe this new guy could work out. Maybe he's okay. And I screwed up. I wanted to believe it. My own confirmation bias, I think, was at work there. We had some evidence that Putin was probably not going to turn out well. Some of my fellow experts disagreed with me. And I think that's an important mark of an expert, is to be able to say that you're wrong. I mean, I wrote a whole section of this book saying, I get it. I'm wrong. You know, I'm listening to the other experts in my field. And I've since reconsidered. So, I mean, my feelings about Putin these days are that he's a very, very dangerous enemy of the United States.
And as someone who is both a Russia scholar and someone who exercises critical thinking, how do you evaluate the reports from intelligence, I'm using this in quote, experts, because I don't really know if they're experts, about this murky Trump-Putin relationship and this idea that Trump's campaign may have colluded with Vladimir Putin and the Russians in order to get elected? How do you evaluate that story?
I think it's good that you put air quotes or scare quotes around experts. Because, you know, there are a lot of people writing on this who are not experts in intelligence matters. They're taking huge leaps and assumptions. My personal view on this, as always my personal view, is that there's so much smoke between the Trump campaign and the Russians that I think there's fire somewhere.
Yeah.
Now, the more nuanced approach to this, I think people have watched too many movies and they're expecting to find some piece of video where Sergei Kislyak, the Russian ambassador, you know, leaves a trunk full of money on the steps of Trump Tower or something. And that's not how these things happen. I mean, I think that there were probably people in the Trump campaign who were inappropriately close to the Russians, may have had discussions or offered negotiations or deals that they weren't empowered to offer. We don't know.
Yeah.
But I think with this much smoke about how many people in the Trump campaign had dealings with Russia, I think it's clear that the Russians had some influence, certainly on the Republican platform when it came to Ukraine. That I think we know. Is there more to it? Is there stuff that was illegal? I think this is where I always counsel people, let the experts sort this out. Yeah. Let the people who are professionals and investigators, you know, figure this out before you jump to wild conclusions.
Do some of the intelligence sources that have expressed concerns, or the British intelligence agent who was the original source of the report, do they seem credible to you based on your experience?
I think anything that comes from a single source is not is immediately, I'm not going to say it's not credible, but single sourcing anything is always a problem of credibility. Mm-hmm. That's the equivalent of an expression I always use here in Rhode Island. That's the equivalent of I know a guy.
Yeah.
Right? Well, how do you know this thing? Well, I know a guy.
But some of our own intelligence agencies are now corroborating various parts of that report, are they not?
But that's how reports like that are written. And that's how some of these misinformation campaigns are done.
I see.
Because when you put together something that you're using to mislead people, you always include nuggets of the truth.
A grain of truth. Yeah.
You would never create something that's a complete fabrication because it's too easy to dismiss as a fabrication. So I personally am not surprised that there are details in this thing, that whatever it is that came out of this report, that were able to be corroborated, because that's just the way those kinds of things happen. I think, again, it's better to wait to let professionals who do this. And you know, part of the problem too, going back to the question of the internet on this, people have gotten used to things happening fast.
Mm-hmm.
And unpacking something like this, unpacking this kind of long trail that includes money and banks and finance and intelligence operations and all this, it takes time. And I think as a people, because of the internet, because of communications and the media, we sort of expect everything to take a day, right? Say, well, we've asked this question and we'll be back tomorrow with the answer. And real life doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
So I think this is going to take time.
Yeah. And I think the biggest takeaway from your book is the biggest defense against the death of expertise is not being lazy, being patient and putting in the time to actually do your homework.
And to take the time to read things. I mean, I can't stress enough that being patient enough to read, you know, I think it's disturbing that we even call it now in journalism, we call it a long read, right? Mm-hmm. What we used to call a magazine article of normal length is now called a long read.
Yeah.
Because people think it's too long. Take the time to actually sit down, read something. And I, again, as a practitioner of social media myself, I'm guilty of this, but I still would advise people, read something and think about it before you comment.
Yeah.
Think about it before you fire off a tweet. That's just a healthier way to approach everything in terms of information.
Yeah. Before we go, do you have a secret to winning at Jeopardy?
Most of the questions on Jeopardy, there's really two things to understand about Jeopardy. One is that if you graduated from high school, you probably know most of the answers.
Really?
But the thing to understand about Jeopardy is they bury the answer right in the question. Usually the clue is right there in front of you. And so it's really important not to overthink a Jeopardy question. Go with your gut, because you probably know the answer. But when you're playing the game on the show, that little button, that little buzzer that you're holding,
yeah,
that's the key to everything. Because I played 8 shows. I came back for the Tournament of Champions and an Ultimate Tournament. So I played about 8 shows altogether. I found that most of the time, all 3 of us were ringing in. We all knew the answer. It was just a matter of who was quickest, because that little buzzer actually locks other people out if you get to it fast enough.
Okay. So fast reflexes are important.
That's the mastering the buzzer is the key to the game. Yes.
Okay. Absolutely. Well, again, the book is called The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. Professor Tom Nichols, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me about it.
Thanks very much for having me, Ben.
In this era of fake news and alternative facts, the best defense our society has against plummeting into a new dark age is reason, curiosity, and yes, a little humility. Folks, there's no intrinsic value in being right. In fact, those who know me well have probably heard me say on more than one occasion that I'd rather be wrong than right. Because while validation and ego stroking is nice, I gain nothing of substance from simply being right. But being wrong, when indeed I am, is always a new opportunity to learn something, and perhaps even to grow as a human being. There's always going to be someone who knows more about something than I do. I'm okay with that. Actually, I'm grateful for it. What a sad thing it would be to be a man who thinks he knows everything and yet knows nothing. And when that man is the most powerful man in the world, with all the resources and expertise at his disposal, but too proud to take advantage of any of it, he is nothing more than a fool sitting atop an idiocracy of his own making. Experts are not the enemy. The media is not the enemy. America's intelligence community is certainly not the enemy. Ignorance, that's the enemy. Thanks again to Tom Nichols for joining me on the podcast. You can order The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge, and Why It Matters on Amazon. You can visit Tom Nichols' website at tomnichols.net and follow him on Twitter at @RadioFreeTom. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. Don't forget to take our listener survey. It only takes 5 minutes at podsurvey.com/kick. You can visit Kick-Ass News on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @KickAssNewsPod. And be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/KickAssNews. Or click on the donate button at kickassnews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.